talking about something to do with quantum gravity, and we'll also be giving a talk on the next Thursday, the Thursday following. And finally, the last colloquium of this year will be Keep Dying 2 weeks from today. We're very happy to have Catherine Callan here with us. Catherine is a friend of Perimeter. I think I first met Catherine on first arriving here 7 years ago. Catherine is a very distinguished condensed matter physicist at McMaster. Followed a path, she's Canadian. She then went to Harvard, did a PhD, then went to KITP, before it was K. And then, those were the good days of the ITP. And then went to McMaster, where she has been for about some long time. And we're very pleased to have her with us today. She's talking about new superconductors.
So it's a pleasure to be here at Perimeter. So today I'm going to talk about some superconductors which we still don't fully understand. I'm going to first start with some general remarks about superconductivity, and then I'm going to talk about three different classes of superconductors. The high temperature cuprates, the iron newly discovered iron superconductors, and then a superconductor that I've become interested in about the last year and a half, which is superconductors with spontaneous time reversal symmetry breaking. So first, a superconductor is defined by the properties that it has perfect conductivity and perfect diamagnetism, which means it expels magnetic fields. And superconductivity was discovered almost 100 years ago, yet we've only really understood the theory behind superconductivity for about 50 years. And part of the reason it took so long is that understanding superconductivity really required new ideas, which were largely provided by Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer, although obviously many others worked in this area. And one of these ideas is that electrons pair, and that's a little bit non-trivial because you have to think of an attractive interaction between electrons which is able to circumvent or overcome the repulsion between electrons due to the Coulomb interaction. And of course, in conventional superconductors, this attractive interaction is provided through the mutual interaction of electrons with the underlying crystal lattice and distortions in that lattice, the so-called electron-phonon interaction. And the other idea that was really new for superconductivity was that all these pairs, which are called Cooper pairs, are coherent. And this is really the property that underlies superconductivity and leads to the phenomena itself. And this is manifested in the fact that superconductivity is described by an order parameter which measures the fraction of coherent pairs, and that all these Cooper pairs have the same phase, which means that there's a non-zero vacuum expectation value for this product of electron field operators. And because superconductivity is described by this order parameter, that means it fits into one of our key paradigms in condensed matter physics. Up until about 20 years ago, essentially all of condensed matter physics rested on two key paradigms, Landau Fermi liquid theory and spontaneous symmetry breaking. And actually both of these are connected to superconductivity because a superconductor condenses out of a Fermi liquid state, and it's an example, or can be thought of as an example of spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the key thing about Fermi liquid theory is just that it tells us that an interacting Fermi liquid is in one-to-one correspondence with a non-interacting Fermi gas, and in particular, they both have a well-defined Fermi surface, and the number of states enclosed by this Fermi surface is independent of the interactions. That last fact is what's known as Luttinger's theorem. And another property of, because of this correspondence, it means that all the quasi-particles in the Fermi liquid, interacting Fermi liquid state, carry exactly the same quantum numbers as the electron. On the other hand, the so all metals are all conventional metals are described as in Fermi liquid theory. On the other hand, we know that Fermi liquid theory is unstable to all sorts of different kinds of ordering. And these are described as states which spontaneously break symmetry, where your ground state has a lower symmetry than the governing Hamiltonian or Lagrangian. And the key characteristic about a system with spontaneous symmetry breaking is that it's described by a local order parameter. In the simple example of paramagnetic spins condensing into an ordered state of a ferromagnet, your local order parameter is just the local magnetization. And if you break a continuous symmetry, which this example would, you're breaking the continuous rotational symmetry in spin space, then we know there must be low-lying excitations, which are Goldstone modes. And nature loves broken symmetry, so examples are all around, including the existence of us, which obviously break all sorts of symmetries, the existence of solids, and of course electrons in solids exhibit all sorts of charge and spin order, which are examples of broken symmetry. So as I said, a superconductor it can be thought of as a spontaneous broken symmetry state because it has an order parameter, and the words we use to describe it often are that it has a broken gauge symmetry. This is the fact that the Cooper pairs all have picked out a single phase, so you've broken a global gauge symmetry. Of course, for a charged superconductor, which is what we're talking about here, this isn't the end of the story, because anything we measure has to be a gauge invariant quantity. And so this order parameter, that is, it has to have a local gauge symmetry, and this order parameter doesn't. And in fact, if you try and write down a gauge invariant order parameter, it's not local. And so in some ways, the example of a superconductor doesn't actually naturally completely fit into the paradigm of spontaneous symmetry breaking, and there's other evidence of that. I mean, for example, the superconductor doesn't actually have a Goldstone mode, and this is understood as a result of the Anderson-Higgs mechanism, which can be understood. One way of understanding that is just due to the long-range Coulomb interaction. So, in fact, as I say, this fitting superconductivity into the paradigm of spontaneous symmetry breaking is not perfect. And in fact, just recently we've come to realize that superconductors actually more naturally fit into the paradigm of topological order. So first, if you look at the field of condensed matter physics over the last 2 decades, much of condensed matter physics has focused on understanding and discovering models and materials which are not examples of Fermi liquids or spontaneous symmetry breaking states. And in particular, much of this is focused on so-called topological order. So it's been known for a while that you can have topological order in states related to this in one dimension. In the last 2 decades, it's been mainly focused on trying to find topological order in 2 and higher dimensions, and for this one typically requires strong interactions, frustration, degeneracy, or some non-trivial band structure. And the most well-studied example of topological order is the quantum and fractional quantum Hall states, which have a topological order. So what is topological order? Well, first, what it isn't a Fermi liquid, it isn't a spontaneous symmetry broken state, it does not have a local order parameter, but there is a kind of underlying quantum order, and this is an area that was really opened up and very significantly contributed to by Xiaogan Wen, who I know just visited here a couple weeks ago. So what are that's what I've said what topological order isn't. It does have some positive signatures to it, this order, and one is that it has a ground state degeneracy which depends on the topology of the underlying manifold. So for example, if you take your two-dimensional quantum Hall states and you put them on the surface of a torus, That has a different degeneracy, the ground state, than if you put it on the surface of a sphere. On the other hand, if you look at it in a finite geometry with edges, then there's very special edge states. These are often chiral edge states that carry the signature of this topological order. And in general, states with topological order exhibit fractionalization, which means that the quasiparticles in this system with topological order carry quantum numbers which are fractionalized from the particles that are actually making up your system. So if you're talking about electrons, they carry different quantum numbers than electrons. In the fractional column Hall effect, they can carry a fraction of the charge. There's other examples where the spin and the charge of the electrons separate and are carried by separate quasiparticles. And that spin charge separation is actually what happens in superconductors. And this is just ordinary superconductors, like a piece of aluminum or lead at low temperatures, exhibits fractionalization and spin charge separation. That's just the fact that the low-lying excitations, the so-called Bugle-Yubov quasiparticles, are known to have a well-defined spin, but no charge, because they're just equal mixtures of electrons and holes. So the lowest lying ones are neutral entities. So we now understand that superconductivity, even just ordinary superconductivity, it actually better fits into our paradigm of topological order, and it does have a degeneracy that depends on the underlying topology. There are edge states, although in most cases for ordinary superconductors, these are gapped, and as I said, it exhibits fractionalization. And I guess this is a key paper that really explained that, although there's a number of other contributions to that. So I'm mentioning this topological order for two reasons. I mean, one, because I just said superconductors fit into that. When I come to my third example of superconductors that break time reversal symmetry, we'll see that they have a topological order that goes beyond what conventional superconductors have. So it's relevant to that. Okay, so turning to specific superconductors, the most widely studied problem in condensed matter physics, certainly in superconductivity, but just in condensed matter physics in general, is the problem of high temperature superconductivity and the Coupe rates. And I think this figure here illustrates why. This is the TCs of known superconductors, not all of them, just characteristic ones, as a function of time, as year, starting with the discovery of superconductivity in mercury in 1911. And you can see these red dots here are the high TC Coupe rates, and you can see it clearly suggests that there's something different going on, and a lot of the excitement in high TC is simply because of the much larger transition temperatures and the fact that we know that these are very strongly correlated electron materials. Well, so to TC, well, actually, I'm not, I think it's the mercury compound. I can't remember, you know, the highest TC that has been reached is actually under pressure is still a little bit below 160. So it's somewhat above what's on this graph, but not much has happened to TC. And of course, you never know whether, you know, we've hit a plateau there. Certainly it was marching up nicely for a number of years, or if we just, you know, have yet to discover it. But, yeah, not much has happened to the transition temperature. So there's a whole range of materials that fall into this category of the high TC Coupe rates. What they all have in common is they have these copper oxygen planes where all the electronic action is, and the rest of the material basically acts as a charge reservoir. When you change the chemistry a bit, you're either adding or subtracting electrons from these copper oxygen layers. So that means you can change the electron density, or what we call dope, change the doping of the system. And that gives you a phase diagram shown here, where this is showing that you can both electron dope or hole dope the materials. And as you do that, you can see they move from an antiferromagnetic insulating state through a region called the pseudogap region into the superconducting state, say if you're going along hole doping. And the superconductivity, you know, in many ways, you know, it's a superconductor, so it has many properties in common with our ordinary BCS superconductor. However, in a This is just changing the electron density. So it depends on the material. Sometimes you change the oxygen. Sometimes you substitute, you know, yttrium for another compound and that. So there's a lot of different ways. But that's basically this chemistry that all these materials, as you fool around with the chemistry, all that happens is, well, the way they fool around with the chemistry is you're adding or subtracting electrons from the copper oxygen layers. So as a theorist, you know, we concentrate on the copper oxygen layers, and you can actually study them as a function of electron density. And I'll come, this special point here is zero doping, the so-called pure parent compound, where you have exactly one electron per site.
When you were talking about topological superconductors, in topology, I'm also to think about the layers. Is this part of the word topology?
Well,
I was confused, I don't.
Yeah, in when we study these materials, first of all, I should say they're all really quasi, very strongly two-dimensional. You know, the interactions along the third direction are very weak. So it's a good approximation. They're just two-dimensional sheets stuck together. In a real material,
the two-dimensional.
Yes, in a real material, unless you work really hard, you're going to have open boundary. You know, you have edges, right? you can work with the Coulomb Hall effect, put it on an annulus, you know, so it's on a cylinder, which will have a different topology, and that. So there's things you can do, but if you don't do anything and you have a chunk of crystal, it's got edges. Yeah, so the topology is really just the surface your electrons live on. So one key difference of this superconductor with ordinary superconductors that we understand is in conventional superconductors, the electrons pair in the simplest possible way. They pair into a zero angular momentum state. That's a S wave state. And then, of course, their spins have to be a singlet, so the whole thing is consistent with Fermi statistics. In the high TC coup rates, it's known that the superconductor is a D wave. Or I should say, so in an S wave, you have an isotropic gap. Nothing depends on angle much there. So you have an isotropic gap around the Fermi surface. Whereas in the coup rates, it's known that the superconductivity is D wave. And so your superconducting gap actually vanishes at four points around the Fermi surface. Where you have quasi-particles, low-lying quasi-particles that disperse linearly, so these are four Dirac points, and you can see the sign of your superconducting gap winds around just as you'd expect for D-wave symmetry. This point here is zero doping, where you have exactly one electron per site, and this, all the coup rates, yes? Yes, actually there's, the electron dope side isn't as well characterized, but yes, it's believed to be D-wave. I'm not aware of any of the real phase-sensitive measurements being done. It's mainly through power law behavior. There are some differences, but, and certainly not symmetric, but there's, physics is quasi-symmetric between electron and hole doping. Zero dope case has exactly one electron per site. So band theory would say that's a half-filled band, because on each site you could put a spin-up electron or a spin-down electron. There's two states. A half-filled band would be a good metal, but it's an insulator. Why is it an insulator? It's just because of the Coulomb interaction. If there's a large Coulomb cost to put two electrons on the same site, and you have exactly, on average, one electron per site, then your lowest lying state will just have the electrons spread out that way, and they can't move. So it's an insulating state. If you go beyond this to look at virtual hops, where electrons hop onto a neighboring site and then paying the Coulomb cost, you'll find that the lowest energy state actually has neighboring spins aligned antiferromagnetically. So this is an antiferromagnetic insulator. It's called a Mott insulator, which is just saying that it's insulating only because of strong Coulomb interaction. It's not a band insulator. And so the problem of understanding the coup rates then, to a large extent, is the problem of understanding a doped Mott insulator. And the model for that is just this so-called Hubbard model, where this is the Coulomb cost I talked about of having two electrons on the same site. This is just a hopping term that hops electrons to neighboring site. Looks like a very simple model. We can't solve this in two and higher dimensions. So we have approximate techniques, numerical techniques, approximate analytic techniques. So it's still an unsolved problem. The overall goal of high-temperature superconductivity is to basically explain all the universal properties of the insulating, the pseudo-gap, I'm going to say more about it in a minute, pseudo-gap region, and the superconducting state within a single theory in a way that we have predictive powers. That would be our goal, and we haven't done this yet. In order to do this, this understanding the pseudo-gap is absolutely key for a number of reasons. I mean, one is, first I should say the pseudo-gap, it isn't a separate phase as far as we know. That is, this is a crossover temperature. It's actually a very distinct crossover temperature, though shows up in almost all experiments at a well-defined temperature, but it's not there's no discontinuities as far as we know. It's not a phase transition. It's called a pseudo-gap because the low energy density of states is strongly suppressed, but it's still acting it's acting somewhat metallic. So the pseudo-gap, first of all, it's key because it connects the antiferromagnetic state, which is the strong correlated Mott insulating state, to the superconducting state. It occupies a large region of phase space in both temperature and doping. And you see over much of the superconducting dome, you enter into the superconducting state by passing through the pseudo-gap phase. And in fact, in many materials, you know, superconductivity falls off fairly rapidly over in this other region where we believe we have a Fermi liquid. So for all those reasons, understanding the pseudo-gap is considered key to the problem. Yep.
Region is a quantum critical region, right?
That's right. I think there's experiments that have tried to track the pseudo-gap temperature down, and it appears to just cross through the superconducting dome, and it's believed to end in a quantum critical point. And so there's certainly theories that believe that, you know, the whole range of behavior here in the space diagram is governed by a quantum critical point, where it's separating off this pseudo-gap region, which is just a doped Mott insulator, from a Fermi liquid. And what you're seeing with superconductivity just getting in the way, if you like, but that's sort of governing the whole normal state properties if you suppress superconductivity. That hasn't been proven, but there's certainly a lot of experiments that support that.
Would you explain why the temperatures are so much higher in this kind of conductor than in the BCS conductor?
I think my bottom line here is going to be, you know, this is not a completely solved problem, but we do know a certain amount about it. I mean, we know this is not an electron phonon superconductor. What is leading to the superconductivity is electron interactions.
If I understand, the antiferromagnetic insulator is something like a big molecule, or like a hydrogen molecule is a singlet.
Right.
So the whole crystal is a singlet, and
right,
you have antiferromagnetism. Things like the opposite electrons. So that's a Coulomb effect.
Yes.
And you disturb that balance slightly by putting an excess of electrons in.
Right, yeah.
However, because the insulator is a Coulomb effect, you have very high energy.
Yes.
Therefore, these high energies somehow have gotten transmitted into the fact of making the electrons mobile with a little excess.
Yeah, well, so the physics of the superconductivity, and the pseudo-gap region are believed to be governed by J, the exchange interaction that comes out when you sort of go beyond this allowing virtual hops. You know, there's this energy scale T squared over U is J. It's what gives rise to the antiferromagnetism, so it's an exchange energy. That energy scale is of the order of 1,000 Kelvin. So you see, you have a high energy scale. So you don't see things at the order of 1,000 Kelvin. You know, the TC is more like 150 Kelvin. But doping also plays a key role there. And the doping, you can see we've got numbers 0.1 to 0.2. You multiply it by the doping, and that's roughly your energy scale. And that kind of scaling analysis, if you like, just very crude scaling analysis on energy scales, is compatible with the physics of a doped Mott insulator. So that kind of general picture we know. What we're struggling with, as I said, the pseudo gap is key, but there's even within that picture of Hubbard physics, Dauphinot insulator, there's all sorts of different physics that comes in. There's, you know, you can have preformed pairs where your triple pairs form, but there's no phase coherence. There's antiferromagnetic and superconducting fluctuations. There's quasi 1D patterns in charge and spin, so-called strike patterns that may be static or fluctuating, depending on the details. There's what's called d-density wave or pi flux phases, where there's no broken symmetry in the charge density, but there's current patterns that that double the periodicity. That is, there's broken symmetry due to the current patterns. There's orbital currents, which are closely related, but here these don't break any symmetry because the orbital currents are all their pattern is within a unit cell, but time reversal symmetry is still broken in that one. And the problem is that, you know, if you look at numerical solutions and you know, approximations to that Hubbard model with finite doping, that, you know, you can get basically all these things can come out of the, we think, you know, we can only solve it exactly. There's susceptibilities for all of these things in the Hubbard model, and there's experimental evidence for all of these in the pseudo-gap region. And so that's part of the problem of, you know, what is actually the key. It seems like the Dauphinot insulator is susceptible to a lot of different fluctuations and ordering, and we're trying to sort out, you know, which one is the key to it. And I think that's what we still don't quite know. And of course, different people will have different ideas depending on, you know, which theories they work on within here. So, yes? Okay, why is there a pseudogap? Or why is there not? Actually, that's actually an old phase diagram. We now know there is a pseudogap on the electron dope, but everything, the energy scale is all a little bit weaker on the electron dope side.
You also have the superconductor and the antiferromagnetic right up against each other on that side, is that?
Okay, so these are sort of generic phase diagrams. I mean, every single material, you get electron dope, dipole dope, you get these phases. The details of, you know, whether there's a gap here, whether they almost overlap, whether they butt up against each other, it seems to be material dependent. And, you know, although, you know, there's some materials we have very good control over as far as doping, you know, we tend to not have control over them over that entire phase diagram. You know, there's certain dopings where you get very nice clean crystals in the underdoped, overdoped, optimally doped, and of course undoped. But it turns out in this region, it's really hard to get a stoichiometric crystal. And, you know, so they may just be disorder effects or something that we don't know whether it's intrinsic or not, the problems we have in really zooming in on that area. Because obviously there's a quantum critical point.
You're pointing at the screen, I can't see.
This area here, there's a lot of problems in really trying to control your sample as a function of doping in that regime. So, obviously high TC has been studied for more than two decades. I don't have time to sort of give you a real overview, but what I do want to just mention one class of experiments, because there's been some really new work done in this, and it's one of the key problems that everyone's puzzling about in this field. And that's the evolution of the Fermi surface as a function of doping. We get information about the Fermi surface through ARPAS, that's angle-resolved photo emission. And in the overdoped regime, we see a large Fermi surface. This is a whole Fermi surface, so it counts the number of holes inside. Remember, we started at one electron per site. We could have equally well called that one hole per site. And we're hole doping, so we're adding holes. So this Fermi surface encloses a number of holes of one plus whatever doping you're at. That all makes sense. That's compatible with Luttinger's theorem. So we say we have a Fermi liquid over here. Same technique, ARPES, when they measure it in the underdoped regime over here, they see what these so-called Fermi arcs. Okay, this is you can't have this in Fermi liquid theory. You don't have pieces of your Fermi surface just disappearing. That's not a possibility. You know, your Fermi surface has to end somewhere or wrap around itself, or end at a zone boundary. So So how do we understand this? Well, there's some experiments that they extrapolate these to low temperature and argue that they just extrapolate to four points. So those would be the same four nodal points that you have in your superconductor, except remember, this is in the normal phase. It's supposed to be our metallic phase that our superconductor is going to condense out of. So that's obviously exotic. There's some theories that predict that, strongly correlated theories of the dopamine insulator. Some theories actually do predict Fermi arcs. They're non-Fermi liquid theories. And other theories are interpret this as actually hole pockets, where due to matrix element effects in the photo emission, you're only seeing part of the Fermi surface. Any way you cut it, all those theories are non-Fermi liquid theories, because Fermi liquid would just say you should take this and just shrink it smaller until you get to one electron per site in the undoped case. But so that was, you know, we knew that picture in 2005. What's new, the first measurements were in 2007, and there's more recent ones this year, is they've used another technique, Shubkov-DeHuss and DeHuss-Van-Alphen oscillations, which also can measure the area enclosed by the Fermi surface. And they actually get a different picture. Actually, they construct this picture. There's a lot of modeling. All they actually measure is they actually measure small electron pockets, whereas all of this is interpretive, if anything, in terms of hole pockets. So they, with their modeling, they interpret this as being compatible with a Fermi surface like this, where we have both electron and hole pockets. There's more scattering on the hole pockets, so they're not visible in their technique. At least that's their assumption. And this is a Fermi surface that you would get if you had a Fermi liquid, and then you imposed spontaneous symmetry breaking that doubled the unit cell, like antiferromagnetism does. Actually, a d-density wave does that too. So this is actually the most conventional picture, because it's compatible with Fermi liquid theory, but it comes along with spontaneous symmetry breaking, which there aren't any experiments that see that. So there's we've never found any evidence of spontaneous symmetry breaking in this phase. So this is something we're struggling with, and also reconciling the different results in the different techniques. And I think you know, I'll just end on the Coup rates by saying that the nature of the pseudo-gap phase is still an open question. And a key question is, you know, what is the evolution? You know, as we leave the Fermi liquid state, you know, what do we actually have in the pseudo-gap phase? So I see by my time, I'm not going to say too much about iron superconductors, because I want to get on to my last topic. But I do want to mention them just because you know, they're very new. And when I said that the high TCs was the most intensely studied subject in condensed matter, that's integrated over time. And of course, it's been around for more than 20 years. The iron superconductors are the most intensely studied subject in condensed matter per unit of time. I mean, this is an area where, you know, there's multiple papers every day. I mean, some days there's more than a dozen papers coming out on this field. It all just opened up in the early part of 2008. And the excitement here is that they've reached TCs of 55 Kelvin, which are second only to the Coup rates. And none of these materials contain any copper oxygen, which was considered to be essential to the physics of the Coup rate. So the big question here is, have they discovered a second route to high temperature superconductivity, or is the physics and the mechanism in these iron arsenide materials the same as in the copper oxide materials? And let me just, you know, emphasize a few key points. There's many similarities between these materials as far as them being layered. They both have antiferromagnetism and superconductivity in close proximity. They're both poor metals. One key difference, so this is just showing the phase diagram that you've got antiferromagnetism and superconductivity. A key difference is, you know, the whole physics of the Coup rates wrapped around this doped mod insulator, which started from the fact that you started with an odd number of electrons, which ended up being, you know, one electron per unit cell near the Fermi energy, and that would have been a metal except for the strong interactions, and that gave us our mod insulator. So that gave us our strongly correlated insulator, which was, upon doping, turned into a superconductor. In these iron materials, you actually start with an even number of electrons, which means it could even be a band insulator. Turns out it's not a band insulator because the bands slightly overlap and you have nearly full and nearly empty bands. But the point is it's going to be a bad metal just because of the chemistry, not even due to interactions. So you're starting from quite a different point, and there's no insulating behavior in the phase diagram. There's still open questions about the symmetry. I should say one thing about this field, being new and moving rapidly, whatever I say now will probably be different. I'd probably say something different 6 months from now because we're really just starting to learn about this field. But what we do know, there's very compelling evidence that this is not an electron phonon superconductor, that electron interactions are playing a role, although whether they're playing the same role as the cuprates is really the big problem. And that's what we're really trying to understand now. And if we could determine with confidence the symmetry of the pairing, like whether it's S wave or P or D wave, that would give us an important clue, because when you have non-S wave pairing, that means your gap is vanishing somewhere, or you have a higher angular momentum. That's a signature that electron correlations are driving the problem, because it's telling you that there's not only is there an attractive interaction which you need to have superconductivity, there has to be a repulsive interaction to actually cause those nodes in the gap. So actually, it turns out the evidence to date on the iron superconductors is a little bit ambiguous as to whether we have nodes or not. Oh, U is just that on-site Coulomb repulsion. The on-site Coulomb repulsion. Okay, so there's theoretical calculations, dynamical mean field calculations, and that estimate set. So the remaining time, I want to turn to this last class of superconductors, the material that this is related to is strontium ruthenate, which was discovered in 1994. By Miano. It's also a quasi two-dimensional system. This is actually your band structure. You see you have nice, there's almost no dispersion in the C-axis direction, so that's telling you it's two-dimensional. All the electronic action is in these ruthenium oxide layers. So this superconducts at 1.5 Kelvin. So after the other two superconductors, you might say, well, why bother? Who's interested in a superconductor with 1.5 Kelvin? Even lead does way better than that. And it's because it's believed that the superconductivity in this material is very unusual and breaks time reverse symmetry. And that signatures of that first became available in the late 90s. This is data by Graham Luke at McMaster, who does muon spin resonance, which is a technique for measuring the local magnetic fields inside your sample. And so what they're seeing here is that there's a signal indicating that there's local magnetic fields inside the sample that just turn on as you go below TC. These are just for muons polarized in two different directions, so you're checking for fields perpendicular to these directions. And so in all directions, they're seeing fields. So this is saying that you have internal fields that just turn on when the system condenses into a superconductor. So that's a sign of a superconductor that breaks time reversal symmetry. Like a ferromagnet or an antiferromagnet would give you a non-zero field. An ordinary superconductor, shouldn't be giving you a moment or field inside the material. There's also NMR data around the same time that pointed towards triplet pairing, whereas the superconductors I've talked about so far are believed, certainly the cuprates and conventional superconductors have singlet pairing. So if you have triplet pairing, that's incompatible with S wave, and the simplest example would be P wave. So these early experiments pointed towards time reversal symmetry breaking and P wave symmetry. So if you put this together with with the crystal structure, that is, if you ask, what P wave states are compatible with a crystal structure that break time reversal symmetry, it picks out a single state, the so-called chiral P wave state or PX plus I PY state. So first of all, when you talk about a triplet superconductor, it's a little bit more complicated than a singlet superconductor, because of course you have three possible states for your spin, then you have to specify the superconducting state, you have to specify the order parameter in each of these for each of these three spin components. So our formalism is we tend to gather that into a little 2x2 matrix with some symmetry. So we have these three independent amplitudes here. So we write this in terms of Pauli spin matrices and what's what we call the D vector, where for the states I'm going to talk about, all the direction of the D vector just tells you about the spin orientation. If the D vector is along the C axis or Z direction, it means that SZ is equal to zero. So the spin is zero along the direction of the D vector, whereas the momentum dependence of the D vector tells you about the orbital degrees of freedom. And with the crystal structure of strontium, well, the simplest P wave you can imagine would just have a momentum dependence of Kx, okay, but that's not very symmetric, or Ky. Or so you might add Kx and Ky together, but that doesn't break time reversal symmetry. The state that breaks time reversal symmetry has Kx plus or minus I Ky, and it's that I that gives you a chirality. So there's two different chiralities here, plus and minus. They're degenerate with each other, and if you have a material that forms a chiral P wave state, it can also possibly have domain walls where part of the sample is and it has positive chirality, the other part has negative chirality, or multiple such domains, since the states are degenerate. So the order parameter pictorially looks something like this. SZ is equal to zero, or equally well, I can think of that, the spins are lying in perpendicular to the Z axis. Because of this chirality in the orbital motion, this state also carries an angular momentum that is along the Z axis. And in fact, it's a P wave state. It carries angular momentum 1. And that's for each Cooper pair. And the entire BCF state carries this macroscopic angular momentum. The number of Cooper pairs, or the number of electrons over 2 times H bar. And I'll come back to that later. So this chiral P wave state, it's known to exist in another system in helium-3 that's a neutral superfluid. So it has somewhat different signatures, but it exists there. It's a topological state. It's actually, Reed and Green showed that it's equivalent to what's called the Moore-Reed state, which is a proposal for the filling factor 5/2 in the quantum Hall system. It supports exotic excitations, Majorana zero modes at edges and vortex cores. And I guess I won't go through the algebra here, but let me just tell you that you know, the if you solve for the excitations of just an ordinary or any superconductor, there's a certain symmetry to the Hamiltonian governing superconductivity that says that for any solution with energy E for your quasiparticles, there's another solution with energy minus E, if you look at the possibility of having a zero energy quasiparticle in a superconductor, that immediately implies a certain symmetry to your solution at zero energy, just from the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, that it has to have the form, in general this would be UV, two independent complex numbers. Because of the symmetry for a zero mode, it has to have the form UU star. Furthermore, if you look at what this means about the quasiparticles that's governed by the state, if you look at the case where you're looking at spinless fermions, or where you're looking at fermions all with the same spin, same thing, that is, if spin is sort of irrelevant and just tags along, then you can show that the quasiparticle creation operator is identical to the quasiparticle destruction operator. I guess in particle physics we would say this is a particle that's its own antiparticle. These are what are called, they obey Fermi statistics, they're Majorana fermions. And they're essentially half an electron, that is, two of these would correspond to an electron. As I mentioned, you sort of need a spinless case, which of course we don't have. It certainly rules out having anything, having Majorana fermions in an S-wave superconductor, because there you need singlet pairing and you always have offset spins. But in the triplet, there's a possibility of having Majorana zero modes, and it comes up in this chiral P wave for the case where the D vector lies in the XY plane. And it turns out you get a single Majorana fermion at the center of a vortex core in a chiral P wave with a D vector in the plane. So one way to see this is if you work through the algebra of the order parameter and the D vector, you can see that you could have a vortex that is actually only a vortex in one of the spin components, say spin up. And so that's exactly the condition that's like a spinless fermion. I'm going to go through sort of a little more physical argument to see why you get exotic stuff if the D vector lies in the plane. So if you assume you have this chiral P wave with the D vector lying in the plane, imagine that you create a vortex where the D vector can rotate around the vortex. So when the D vector rotates around the vortex, one can show that it picks up a phase factor of pi. So that means in order to have a single valued wave function or order parameter, the orbital part of your wave function also only has to pick up a factor of pi. In an ordinary superconductor, the orbital part of the wave function orbiting a vortex picks up a factor of 2 pi. So for it to only pick up a factor of pi means it only has to enclose a flux of half of the superconducting flux quantum. And of course, remind you, the superconducting flux quantum is already half of the fundamental flux quantum, because in a superconductor you have 2e rather than e, and the flux quantum is hc over e. So this is like a quarter of a fundamental flux quantum. It's an excitation that's allowed only if your d vector lies in the plane and is free to rotate. In that case, you meet the conditions exactly that I spelled out on the previous transparency. You have a single Majorana zero mode bound at the vortex core. Since you're, I should have mentioned this, in the chiral P wave state, in the bulk, the whole state has a gap, because if you take Px plus I Py, you take the magnitude of that, it doesn't vanish anywhere. It's just Px squared plus Py squared, square root of that. So you have a single Majorana zero mode, and it's protected because there's no other low-lying excitations in the bulk for it to mix with. Of course, you can't really create a half a fermion. It means you either create two of these vortices, or if you create one, you're going to create a Majorana fermion at the boundary of your system. But the bottom line is that you can create an isolated Majorana fermion. You can show that these Majorana fermions that are bound at these vortex cores, when you interchange them, they actually obey non-abelian statistics, which means that they're not it's not a simple phase factor on your wave function. It's actually, so this is a topological state that has a finite degeneracy on a non-trivial manifold, when you exchange these Majorana fermions, that is, exchange these vortices, you're actually changing from one of these topological states to another, because you're multiplying your state by a matrix rather than a phase factor that changes you to a new state. So this is exactly what people in quantum computing want. They want, you know, states that are topologically stable that you could manipulate by moving around each other and know that you switch from one topologically stable state to another topologically stable state that isn't going to decohere because of interactions. And here, you know, the gap protects this. So that's what a lot of the interest in strontium-ruthenate and related problems is this idea that it actually seems to be a physical manifestation of a system that could give us non-abelian statistics useful for quantum computing.
Where the D vector comes from?
Well, the D vector is sort of, it's a little bit mathematical in that, it's just a way of parameterizing the superconducting order parameter for a triplet. So first of all, you know, for a triplet superconductor, you need three deltas, if you like, you know, three amplitudes. I have to tell you the pairing in all three of these channels.
And that D is an orbital D?
Well, it's both. It contains the information about the spin, that is, the direction that D points in tells you the spin is equal to zero along that direction, or if you like, the spins are perpendicular to the direction of D. So for example, in strontium ruthenate, spin orbit coupling actually depends on the D vector along the C axis. So that's telling us that in strontium ruthenate, if it's a triplet superconductor, the spins are lying in the AP plane. And that will be described by D vector that points along the Z direction. But D also has momentum dependence, that's telling us about the orbital degree of freedom of the order parameter. If you like, if someone tells you the D vector, they told you the order parameter. Because, you know, everything else here is just poly-spin matrices, you know, that are just, you know, putting them together in the right order. So you tell me the D vector, you've told me the order parameter. And the reason it's a vector is because it's a triplet, and I have to tell you three amplitudes. I know, if you're not used to it, it always seems a bit strange for the first time. It's so much easier working with singlet superinductors. But so anyways, you know, the last thing I said was, you know, that they're excited, they're interested in this in quantum computing. There's some excitement because the latest NMR data suggests that you may, even though in strontium ruthenate, spin orbit coupling pins the D vector along the Z axis, that's not what we want. We'd like the D vector in the AB plane. I'm not going to go through it, but there's recent NMR data that suggests that a fairly modest magnetic field might be sufficient to rotate the D vector. I want to mention a couple other experiments. One is the polar Kerr effect, because this is a very direct measurement of the chirality of the state. So here you shine linearly polarized light on your sample, and if there's a chirality to your state, what's reflected back is elliptically polarized. And that can just be understood. That says that your system is preferentially absorbing either right circularized light or left circularized light, because, you know, linear polarization is just equal superposition of that. So the fact that you are absorbing one of these means your system has to have a chirality, you know, to know which one to absorb. And this is just experimental data where they observed a non-zero polar Kerr effect on strontium ruthenate that, again, just turns on at TC. So that's a direct measurement of the chirality. And the theory of, so that was discovered in 2006. The theory went through some ups and downs because it turns out if you have a clean system, that is a system with translational invariance or Galilean invariance, one finds that first of all, in general, the Kerr effect is directly related to the Hall conductivity. And to have a non-zero Kerr effect, you also need a non-zero Hall conductivity. If you put a magnetic field on, you expect to get a non-zero Hall conductivity. But it turns out that just spontaneously breaking time reversal symmetry isn't enough to give you a non-zero Hall conductivity, because you can show by Galilean invariance that you don't get a Hall conductivity from spontaneous symmetry breaking. Actually, there is interesting physics that goes on at finite K, and that's a problem we studied. Unfortunately, experimentally, they aren't able to probe at finite K. So you need something to break the translational symmetry to understand these experiments. And it took a while because the lowest order contributions due to impurities, which we, in condensed matter, we can always invoke impurities to break our symmetry. It actually turns out that still gives you a vanishing contribution. It was actually Goryeo who identified the lowest order contribution, where an impurity scatters three times off quasiparticles in the superinducting state. That gives you a non-zero contribution to the Hall conductivity. It's unfortunate, it's still a bit small, but it's within a factor of five or so of the experiment. So there's still something to be understood there. One final point I want to make is, remember I mentioned this large angular momentum. And, you know, because of the state actually carries an angular momentum, it means that there's actually supercurrents, spontaneous supercurrents in the ground state flow at the edge of the sample. Now, this is a little bit distinct from just this zero mode. This is actually a charged supercurrent flows at the edge of the sample. Of course, if you have a supercurrent, charged current flowing at the edge of your sample, that means you've got a magnetic field inside that current loop. And a superconductor can't have a magnetic field, that would destroy it. That means there's an equal and offset screening current must flow. However, so this is what this is a prediction. This is what we expect for a chiral P-wave superconductor, that it has equal and offset spontaneous currents flowing at the edge of the sample. And because they have a different distribution, there should be a magnetization at the edge of the sample that we can see, or at the same would be true along domain walls. So this is something one should see. There's beautiful scanning squid and scanning Hall probe measurements. Let me just go to this, which is sort of the summary. This is what the experimentalists see. It's exactly what you might expect if you had an S-wave superconductor. This is the prediction for chiral P-wave, and you see it's supposed to go off there to one. They don't see the edge currents that are expected, and that's actually a real puzzle because, you know, we've looked at effects like rough surface pair breaking effects on that, and you know, what we need to reconcile those experiments is getting the edge currents down by about two orders of magnitude. So the only proposal I know that gets anywhere near, you know, being able to reconcile the experiments not seeing this is Tony Leggett has a proposal for an alternative wave function to BCS. Now, this is quite controversial because BCS wave function has been around for a long time. But, you know, it turns out that in the BCS wave function, you know, you're basically creating these Cooper pairs on the vacuum. And the fact that you create them all the way down to your bottom of your band doesn't really matter, because most of this is just filling it up with Fermi states that don't do anything. That is, they're just they're just filled below the Fermi C, like they would be in the normal state. But in a chiral P wave, there's a very special winding that goes with these phase factors, and this BCS is actually predicting that the superconducting state has this large angular momentum because of this winding. And what Tony's wave function actually does is remove essentially almost all of these windings to leave only a residual angular momentum that's down typically by four or five orders of magnitude. I actually find it a quite a compelling, interesting idea, but I'm in a minority so far in the condensed matter community. I think a little bit more work needs to be done to understand this. I think I'll skip that given the time and just go to conclusion. So in strontium ruthenate, a number of questions remain about the symmetry, because as you see, we've got these conflicting experiments where we didn't see all the signatures we expected for time reversal symmetry breaking. There's certainly open questions about the, in particular, the angular momentum. On the other hand, there is really compelling evidence for time reversal symmetry breaking in chiral order, but the lack of these edge currents is puzzling. And I should mention, you know, even if Tony Leggett's wave function was right, it's not an answer to everything. It doesn't reconcile all the experiments. In fact, it would make the signal for the muon spin resonance experiments also be unobservable, and yet they observe something. So we do have a problem there to be sorted out. In the cuprates, as I mentioned, we can't solve the Hubbard model, but we have all sorts of approximate solutions, and it tends to yield many competing orders. And many of these are seen experimentally, but we still don't have a clear picture of exactly what is needed for the high temperature superconductivity. And in the iron superconductors, it's a rapidly moving field. And right now, we're just focused on the question of, do we have something very similar to the cuprates, or do we have something different? And most of the experiments are done with that question in mind. I'll end there.
Questions, comments? Okay, that's my reference. This once told me that the Hubbard model is like string theory of your field, and that it's got lots and lots of things in it, and you don't see any of it, you still believe it 20 years later.
You don't see any of it? We see all of it.
I'll picture it.
How do you falsify the Hubbard model picture? So the Hubbard model is the model that allows us to understand the mod insulator. And it gives all the physics that we've observed in a mod insulating physics is contained in a Hubbard model, in the Hubbard model. Okay. Of course, for that you don't need doping, right? The doped problem is so we use that then at finite doping, knowing that we're starting from a Hubbard model. I'd say, I don't know if this answers your question, but just to show you the level we're at, you know, one key question that people disagree on is, does the Hubbard model, the 2D Hubbard model square law support D-wave superconductivity? You know, that would seem to be a pretty fundamental question, right, for applying it to the Coupe rates. You know, there's different answers to that. I think, you know, the Sherbrooke group, their numerical technique, which involves a number of approximations, they say yes, and then from EDU, they get out D-wave. I know, you know, Scalfino and others that have worked on this feel they have to add an extra J term. You know, there's an exchange term that comes out of the Hubbard model if you expand T, if you treat T as a perturbation hopping. But given a T, you know, there's a certain J that goes with that. They have to sort of enhance J. They feel to get a superconductivity. You know, most of us wouldn't consider that fundamental, except from a theorist point of view. You'd sort of like to know what the minimum model is and what range of parameters. And so I don't, you know, I don't think it's so much that the Hubbard model gives us all sorts of things we don't see. It's the fact that we don't actually, you know, we only have approximate solutions to the Hubbard model. And sure, we can use experiment to guide us, but, you know, then, you know, I mean, that's pretty unsatisfactory if we don't even know if it's supported by the Hubbard model. So I'd say, you know, why we're talking about a 20-year slayer because we haven't solved it. We solved it, you know, maybe we know its limitations, right? Looks very simple, doesn't it?
I remember there was an exchange between Laughlin and Anderson where it's just what I understood Laughlin saying is that maybe the whole Hubbard model picture is just wrong. And so that raised the question of how would you decide why is that not a research direction?
Well, it is. But, you know, it's not an easy one. Like, you know, I mean, they basically use the entire, you know, computer power they have at their disposal with all the techniques they have at their disposal. To get what they think are the best approximations to the Hubbard model solution, and it's still in dispute as to what the answer is over any range of doping, other than zero doping. Zero doping, we understand. Have you studied that, Roger? And would you agree with, or you have a different?
Yeah, I think the only reason that model is unsolved is because of the quantum line for a sign problem.
Yeah, if you can solve the sign problem, yeah. Yes.
You can solve it on finite size clusters, which is what the Sherbrooke group does. But you're dealing with this exponential Hilbert space, and you can only do 10 spin or 10 electrons or something like that. So the question is, well, what is the physics that you see in this small system that really mean? You're nowhere near the thermodynamic limit.
Right. And then we have approximate techniques that, you know, can go to the thermodynamic limit, but they've got really crude approximations in them, right? So.
This is the same sign problem that makes fermions and landscapes good.
Yeah, it's the same sign problem.
That the measure is not constant.
That's right, yeah. So that's one of the more fundamental problems in the field.
Yeah, and even it's a problem in our area, and I guess it's not exclusive to our area, but it might be the only problem in our area that made it on David Gross's top 10 list or something. Which shows how important it is because he's a straight theorist.
Yes.
Could you say a bit more about spin charge separation in more than one dimensions?
Well, yeah. So in one dimension, you know, that's what you get, right? Examples of spin. The only proven example of spin charge separation in more than one dimension is a superconductor. Okay, and I don't know if you're familiar with that, the Bunge-Lyapunov quasiparticles. You can see just from their formula, you know, their linear combinations of, you know, the operator that creates a quasiparticle is a linear combination of a C dagger and a C, you know, creates an electron and destroys an electron. The lowest lying ones are right at the Fermi energy where the amplitude in front of the C dagger and C are equal. So that carries zero charge and carries well-defined spin 1/2. There's all sorts of models for spin charge separation in higher dimensions. These are, you know, our so-called spin liquid models of, you know, and, you know, And there are some proposed materials like, I guess, you know, cesium copper chloride, the Herbert Smith thing, there's one of the organics that has a long name. You know, at least a couple of these, well, I'd say the organics are probably, the beta looks the best, but there hasn't been any smoking done. So we have, you know, I have to say at this point in time, we don't have a clear experimental confirmation as we do like in the quantum Hall effect, and we know there's fractal charge. We don't have that for spin charge separation outside of superconductivity, but there's lots of models, not, and they're not exact, right? Although, I guess Sandy in Princeton, he has one model that is, he can solve exactly the limit that does give spin charge separation, but whether it connects to a physical system is another question.
Oh, besides materials in which spin leaflets could happen, well, what do you think of engineering them, like in optical lattices or arrays or just in
So the cold atom guys are breathing down our necks, right? I mean, everything that we talk about, you know, they talk about just designing and creating, you know, the chiral free wave, the Meyerlocker fermions, you know, spin charge separation, fractal charge, everything, right? A lot of Boolean statistics. And that they've got their own problems, right? but on the other hand, you know, it's amazing what they can do with lasers. But you know, to really, you know, get our systems, you know, they really, you know, and one thing, you know, the nature does for us is gives us these beautiful periodic arrays of crystals, right? And we don't have to worry, you know, about, you know, the well over here, 1,000 lambda spacings away, is off by 10^-6 or something. You know, it's nature breaks that symmetry for us and gives us. So that's the advantage we have. We have, you know, real crystals that come with tremendous symmetries that are exploited, you know, because we're assuming translational symmetry and all that. Whereas the laser guys have to create this by tuning everything, and I don't know where they are, but you know, and they have few quantum wells with the kind of precision you need. But you know, it's a very challenging problem. But certainly, they're working hard on it. I don't know. You know, that's another field that will change. You know, from every few months, right? And I don't know exactly where they are at the moment, but you know, they're not near getting one of these states. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me ask a very simple question. So does time reverse breaking mean it's also CP breaking?
No. Well, yes, that's right. Yes, it breaks parity, right? Yeah. Yes. Because it has to.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.